You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
This morning, with negotiations continuing to stall and its own deadline for ending the war approaching, US President Donald Trump threatened civilizational destruction if Iran did not concede to US demands to open the Straits of Hormuz. Whether a sincere threat or an act of brinkmanship may remain unclear, as just before Trump's deadline, he claimed a two-week ceasefire had been agreed to. And last week, the Green Party released their housing policy, A Home for Everyone. It takes a welfare-based approach, pitching rent controls, reversing tax breaks on the Bright Line test, and a public housing building program. So for our weekly catch-up of the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, we discuss the gravity of Trump's threats on Iran, but we begin with the Greens' housing platform. Okay, kia ora, Ricardo.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
I want to cover a few topics today. I want to cover your Homes for Everyone policy. Is that right? Homes for Everyone? Homes for Everybody?
Yeah, that's correct.
And then I also feel like it would be appropriate to comment on Trump's civilizational destruction comments on Iran. I think we should start off with the Greens policy, though. And I want you to lay out for our listeners what the intention behind the policy is, and then maybe we'll go through and clarify what some of the statements mean. And yeah.
Our country has been facing a housing affordability crisis for many years, and this means that young people are getting locked out of putting roots in the community, being able to save up for a home, and giving up on things that actually shouldn't be nice to haves and essentials in order to pay rent. So this is why we put out a plan to ensure that we can build enough public housing to clear the waiting list, also capping rent increases to 2% to ensure that wages and incomes are overall rising faster, and also getting rid of no-cost evictions, which we know have led to an increase in people being at risk of homelessness, as well as introducing what we call a rental warrant of fitness for rental homes, which is basically plugging in the gaps from the healthy home standards, which we know haven't been enough to ensure that people aren't going into flats that are moldy, that are cold, that are in poor conditions. So it's a policy package that we've actually held for quite some years, but we are recommitting to it as well.
Awesome. Okay, so there's the renters' rights bill, so that would be the cap and the reversing no-cost evictions for rental stability and the warrant of fitness. There was also the increasing public housing, which would, I assume, would be a different policy gearing, wouldn't be part of the renters' rights bill. It's been tried before. Labor in 2017 famously tried, you know, they promised a lot of public housing and people feel they undershot that.
Mm.
Do you have any ideas about how to get the ball rolling on that?
Yeah. As somebody who was extremely critical of the former government's approach to housing bills, including before I was an MP and as an MP, what we would do different is that we don't believe that the government should be basically carving out land and giving most of that land for private developments that was previously made for state housing developments. This is what we called mixed tenure housing. And this is something that the Labour government did that really, in my view, hindered the ability to deliver on adequate public housing supply. And this is why in some neighbourhoods, what we've seen is basically land that was previously only for state housing, now actually predominantly being private housing. We think this was a mistake, and it really damaged the ability to deliver on enough affordable public housing. And the key thing about public housing here is that it's public housing that people don't spend more than 25% of their weekly income on rent. So we do think that what the Labour government did missed the mark on quite a few areas. And I think the focus on Kiwi Build as opposed to public housing meant that they didn't get to deliver as much of an increase in public housing as people deserved. So we acknowledge the failures of the previous government, and this is why we commit to doing differently.
And on the reversing nationals' tax cuts, which I saw was a part of the policy, they say for landlords and property speculators. What's the difference here between this? Is there a single tax cut that's being referred to, or is it two?
Yeah, so like the Bright Line test that we would bring back, and I mean colloquially known as the sort of like landlord tax cut that was given by this government. But basically what this tells us is that, you know, the government tells us all the time that we can't afford nice things for everyday people. We can't afford adequate healthcare. We can't afford to build enough public housing. We can't afford to lift people out of poverty. But the government seemingly was able to afford losing $3 billion in revenue through these landlord tax cuts. This is why we think that actually our tax system should actually ensure that the wealthiest few pay their fair share and property speculators pay their fair share. So that is why we're committing to overhauling the tax system. If you look at our broader tax policy, though, we also recognize that everyday people at the moment pay a lot of tax on work. And this is why we've long called for a tax-free threshold for the first 10 grand that you earn.
Within like the existing housing policy spectrum of support that the government does provide, New Zealand does provide some amount of support compared to other countries, right? We have rates rebates, and we have the accommodation supplement, but we do have some sort of interesting quirks, right? We also have an investment tax cap of 28%, where our income tax cap is 39%. When we're talking about dealing with property speculators or investors, would this come in there, or is this barking up the wrong tree?
I think successive governments have led us to believe that governments have taken an active role in providing affordable housing, and that hasn't been the case for decades. New Zealand actually has one of the lowest proportion of public housing out of all the sort of, you know, quote-unquote developed countries in the whole world. We have very little public housing compared to other countries, and that means we also have, therefore, very little affordable public housing compared to other countries, and that's exacerbated our housing crisis. And yeah, we're effectively a tax haven for property speculators as well. These are things that are undermining our ability to deliver the right type of housing supply. We acknowledge that rent controls cannot work if you don't commit to the housing supply as well. And I do want to point out that where rent controls have, you know, supposedly failed, it's actually places where you had rent controls, you took them away, and then you saw a massive increase in rents, which actually shows that rent controls were working to prevent a big increase in rents. So I do want to point that out, because I know that other political parties have shied away from proposing a cap on rent increases. And I just want to call out the fact that where they say it hasn't worked, it's because they removed them and then rents increase, which shows otherwise.
Would the intention here then be to have a more long-term rent controls? Would that be the plan?
We should have permanent rent controls. It doesn't have to be a temporary measure now.
Right. I want to move on while we still have time to what's happening in Iran. When this airs today, we'll be just past the deadline that Trump gave for reopening the Straits of Hormuz and ending negotiations with Iran. In part of that, he said a whole civilization will die tonight if Iran does not concede. How should a country like New Zealand and a society respond to a world leader, especially one as powerful as Trump, suggesting something like this?
It's an escalation of the fascist and genocidal rhetoric that Trump has carried for some years now. And I mean, it is, and I mean it when I say it's fascist and genocidal to threaten to wipe out a whole civilization. What this should be prompting us to do is to rethink our alliances with the United States, including military alliances. We should not be having military alliances with a country that is very openly and shamelessly threatening to commit war crimes and genocide in a whole civilization. And so I think how we should be responding is by genuinely pulling out of AUKUS, of the Five alliances, and actually have an independent foreign policy. We cannot call ourselves a country that respects international rules-based order if we're just allying ourselves with a country that is doing the exact opposite.
In RNZ this morning, they made a story about Winston Peters talking to US Secretary of State Marco Rubio and calling for calmer heads, for cool heads to prevail. How do you feel that the current government is responding to this? Is it appropriate? Is it inappropriate?
I don't think it meets the challenges that we're facing when Trump is literally threatening to commit war crimes and a genocide on a whole civilization. I don't think just saying that we need calmer heads is enough. I think we've reached a point of considering the consequences of having alliances with a country that is openly threatening to commit war crimes. And so I don't think we'll have much leverage by saying that people should be calm. I think our leverage comes from putting into question the military alliances that we've built over the years. And until we do so, I think the US will just completely disregard our position on the international stage, because they'll see us as powerless, they'll see us as unprincipled, and will see us as just being able and willing to bootlick the United States government without any consequences for their actions, including openly threatening to commit genocide on a whole civilization, which is, you know, the kind of things you thought that we left behind after the Second World War.
Does New Zealand have a misconception that it is less powerful or less influential than it really is? I mean, we're within the Indo-Pacific region. You know, we just struck a renewed military agreement with the Cook Islands, which was a big point of contention between China and America. It definitely feels, though, that a lot of the time we perceive ourselves to not be important, and so therefore we should keep our heads down and not respond to these things.
We often sell ourselves short on the international stage, and we've got to remember that if every country acted like their voices didn't matter on the international stage, there would be no point in us coming together and forming a rules-based order that was about peace and about, and theoretically, justice as well. And so we have a duty to stand up for human rights. We have a duty to stand against genocide. We have a duty to stand against fascism. How much our voice counts on the international stage actually matters very little. It's about taking a principled stand. If every country stops doing that, then it's a free-for-all, and we could be vulnerable to countries and big countries that just want to do the exact same thing that Trump is trying to do to Iran just because they don't like the leader. This does not mean that the Iranian regime isn't oppressive and authoritarian, but that's very different from whether a whole civilization deserves to be wiped out, basically. And that should never, ever, ever be something that is even joked about or considered.
Okay. I might tie things up here then. Is there anything you want to say, anything you want to leave our listeners with in relation to maybe the Iran stuff especially?
We as a country can not only ensure that we have a principled position on the international stage and that we stand up to the United States or to China, no matter who they are, and when it comes to making sure that there's peace and justice in this world. But equally, we can also have an economy that puts everyday people first. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. And this is what the Green Party will be fighting for us to be an independent state with our own principled positions internationally, but one that also looks after people, houses everyone, and ensures that people have dignified work available to them when they need it.
Awesome. Well, thank you very, very much for joining me.
Thank you, Manuel. Appreciate it.
That was Green MP Ricardo Menendez-March discussing the Green Party's housing for everyone and the Iranian conflict and Trump's statements on that. And on that statement, I'll just read the listeners a part of The Guardian's commentary on this now. The foreign minister of Iran has confirmed that they are going to abide by the ceasefire and will be opening the Straits of Hormuz for safe passaging. We will obviously see how that pans out in the coming 2 weeks, which is the length of the ceasefire.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.